Ladies and gentlemen, we're in for another treat with our next speaker. Simon Longstaff is a philosopher who has been the Executive Director of the St James Ethics Centre since 1991. The St James Ethics Centre provides a non-judgmental forum for the promotion and exploration of ethics. Simon is passionate about the integration of ethical considerations in the strategic thinking of business leaders, and indeed, the exploration of ethical thinking within the wider community. Please welcome Simon Longstaff.
Well, good morning, everybody, and thanks very much for the invitation to join you today. And thanks, Bernard. Bernard and I occasionally appear on the same stage. And it's remarkable how neatly the things he has to say fit into the sorts of things that I want to talk about too. So a lot of what I want to talk about this morning is to, if you like, start to chart something of the ethical landscape within which actuaries might work. I want to talk a little bit about the notion of a profession, but I'm going to save that to the end because of its importance in responding to some of the issues that I want to outline. But largely, I want to begin by embroidering, I suppose, upon some of the points that Bernard has been making and perhaps draw out a few of the issues that might arise from what he's been talking about. And I want to start off with those slides that he was showing. I apologise, I haven't got any numbers or slides. It's just me this morning. But I am going to refer to Bernard's numbers, because if you look at the issue that he's talking about in terms of the increase in the age to which we might all aspire to live, and some of the implications that flow from that. One of the things which we haven't really started to talk about yet is what this is all going to mean for those younger generations that are sitting there parked, waiting for opportunities to take control of the ship of state. What are they going to do? Are they going to sit there indefinitely, Generation X and Y, constantly adjusting the time frame within which they might move out of home, enter into adult life? And while they're waiting, is there going to be the prospect of some kind of pent-up frustration about the fact that their parents and sometimes their grandparents are continuing to hold on to the levers of power, whether they're economic or political, for what seems to them to be an almost indefinite period? One of the things I think we have to look at is whether or not it's going to be possible for us to actually deal with a transition process which consciously establishes some kind of social compact which gives rise to opportunity for new generations, not simply to step aside from the traditional paths that they might otherwise have followed and do something new, which could be innovative and creative, but rather to take on leadership responsibility within institutions where older people are having to redefine the role that they play. The reason why I think there might be a need to consider some kind of explicit social compact is that the baby boomers, and I suspect that most of us in this room are in that generation, are unlikely to take too many risks with their own future unless there is some kind of understanding about the way in which they're going to be treated when they finally let go of the levers of power. And so I'd expect to see coming forward a conversation about this. I don't know how it's going to be started, what's going to make it explicit, but that's going to be one of the issues that I think we need to look at. Second thing, touching on Bernard's last point, is to do with the rise of moral consumerism. I agree that this is happening. In fact, you can see this now in the purchase decisions that are being made by Australian shoppers. One of the things I do is chair the corporate responsibility panel for Woolworths, and we look from time to time at seeing the way in which different categories of goods and goods, in their cases, are being sold in the Australian economy. And although the acceleration in the purchase of brands like Macro, which explicitly identify themselves with things to do with organic and animal welfare issues and other things, while that has not been as fast growing in Australia as it has been, for example, in Europe, nonetheless, there is real and sensible evidence in terms of the actual dollars that people are prepared to spend to show that consumers are wanting to make choices in that direction. In fact, there's a fascinating piece of research which has been conducted in a series of what he calls clinical trials by an Australian academic based at Harvard, Professor Michael Hiscox, where he's actually doing well-controlled experiments to see what kind of value is added for companies which are able credibly to attach to their brands some kind of symbol ensuring that there is, if you like, an environmental, social benefit as part of the product. For example, he will take products which are high volume, relatively low value, with identical characteristics and attached to one of them just some kind of mark that indicates that they have those sorts of credentials, and can see increases in sales, but also an increase in the value of the that people are prepared to part with for those products. So moral consumerism, it's here in Australia, it's growing. I think it has something to do with an aspiration for people starting to emerge from that sort of retreat within to the family or community or tribe that Bernard talked about. But that retreat was partly being offset by an idealism which is latent within people, but which is now being conditioned by two factors. Firstly, people are reluctant, and I think this is still true, reluctant to join organisations. They don't want to have to sign up to things as part of the way that they exercise their commitment to their ideals, which is why you see a reduction in the membership of service clubs, a reduction in the membership of political parties. People want to be able to operate either within a small group, which is defined by their immediate community or friends, however they're defined, whether in real time or on Facebook, or they want to act alone. And they also want to be able to make a difference, but only, if you might put it, as a dollar at a time. There's not the same appetite for large gestures, major political movements, major events. If you give the person a chance to, say, spend as little as a dollar by way of a contribution to some cause or through their purchases, then they're prepared to take that opportunity and, in a sense, say that that is how they begin to express themselves in terms of some of their ideals. But, although that might present an opportunity for some organisations, particularly in the commercial space, to tap into that sentiment, there is extreme scepticism and cynicism at work in relation to those sorts of opportunities. About 20 years or so ago, Hugh McKay, noted Australian social researcher, undertook a piece of research which asked members of the community to talk about the extent to which they were prepared to trust businesses. And the research showed some not surprising findings, the first of which was that people wanted the businesses to tell them what it was that they actually stood for. What are your values and principles? Who are you? What do you stand for? And then, although there was scepticism at that time, people were prepared to suspend their disbelief if there were at least two pieces of evidence available to them. The first thing that members of the community would ask of these businesses is, well, how do you treat me? You say that these are the things that you think are good and right, but do you treat me in a manner which is consistent with that? And people said, oh, well, that's a bit ho-hum. Obviously, in areas of customer service, you want to have that kind of alignment. But even 20 years ago, people were saying, if you treat me in a manner consistent with your values and principles, that may be necessary, but it is not sufficient. Because what I will also look to see is how you treat each other in that organisation. Because if I can see an inconsistency between what you say you stand for and the way that you treat each other, then I will conclude that your treatment of me is just part of a marketing scam. Because if you were genuinely committed to those things that you say, you wouldn't quarantine an important set of relationships, such as those that exist within your organisation, as being undeserving of their application. Well, the news is that in the intervening years, what members of the community now do, because of this deep scepticism, is not merely ask themselves, how do you treat each other in that organisation, but they consistently sense every single relationship which is of significance to the organisation, looking for the example which contradicts the claim that the company makes. They want to know, how do you treat your suppliers? They want to know how you treat your competitors, how you operate in the marketplace. This rise of moral consumerism has been matched not just with a desire to be able to do some things which might be relatively small gestures as part of a commitment to idealism, but also to look for consistency across the full span of relationships. In other words, they're looking not just for the surface of things, but of depth. And Bernard was talking about the difference between Susan Boyle and Paris Hilton. Just to take that idea and to put it in a larger context, some years ago I had the privilege to hear Umberto Eco, the famous Italian academic and writer, talking in a forum. It was in Davos in Switzerland, where he distinguished the ancient world from the modern world by saying that the difference was that the ancient world had heroes, whereas the modern world only had celebrities. And the difference between those two was that the hero was a person of depth, whereas the celebrity was simply a person that had glittering surfaces. Well, I think what Bernard's been pointing to, and I'd agree with him on this, is that there is a reawakening interest of things of depth. And they're looking at this in terms of individuals, but they're particularly looking at organisations and institutions in terms of how they go and assess them in terms of their degree of being involvement. This is allied with a profound loss of trust in institutions. Virtually every institution in society at the moment, if you ask ask the community who do they trust, hardly any organisation is mentioned. When I first started my work, the regular references were made to the Salvation Army, Australia Post, because presumably your letters were regularly delivered, and the CSIRO. Salvation Army, at least for a period of time, I think it's dropped off that list, and I suspect that Australian Post is probably still there along with the CSIRO, although they may even be damaged because of the climate wars that have taken place. That's extraordinary to think of a society that there are so few institutions that people trust, whether in the private sector or the public sector. There are some important reasons for why that trust has been lost. I can illustrate the two of them, and both of them are major challenges to ethics, by two quick stories. The first involves a former Prime Minister of Australia, Gough Whitlam, who was called upon to give a speech in the Mansion House in London to the good and great from the city, where he was going to discuss Australia's economic policy during his brief period as Prime Minister. And his host on this particular occasion was an arch-conservative Lord Mayor of London. And Whitlam was wondering what he was going to say by way of a few informal remarks before getting into this rather dry economic text. And so he didn't think he had anything in common with this man as a politician because of the difference in their political perspectives, but he did notice on a briefing sheet provided by a protocol officer that there was one outstanding fact about this man's career to which he could relate. And that was that the then Lord Mayor of London was a distinguished oarsman. He'd rowed for his school, he'd rowed for his university, he'd gone on and he'd rowed for Great Britain. So Whitlam stood up and said, "Your Worship, my lords, ladies and gentlemen, I came here this evening thinking that His Worship and I had absolutely nothing in common. But now I see that we are united by one thing, because as you know, he is a distinguished oarsman and I am a politician, and the thing that unites us is that we both look one way and go the other." Well, not a lot has changed, I suppose, in the years since he was Prime Minister. But it's not just politicians that look one way and go another. It's business leaders, you can see leadership in almost any category where people will say one thing and do something else. And the effect of this is disastrous for institutions, large and small. More than anything else, perhaps, this has given rise to that kind of scepticism or cynicism that I talked about that has the community sensing so closely for every key relationship to see if there's an alignment. Perhaps the most spectacular example you can see of just how major institutions can be damaged by this is what's happened to the Christian churches, and particularly the Catholic Church, since the allegations emerged about the sexual abuse of children by members of the clergy. Here were institutions which have said for 2,000 years and just over it, that love is more important than the law, that people are more important than property, that you should face the truth about yourself and your place in the world. And yet when the allegations were raised and the response came, it was precisely the opposite. It was the law that was put before love, property before people, and a desire to protect their backs rather than face the truth. And although the actual deeds themselves that gave rise to this crisis were abhorrent, it was that response, in the sense that it violated the very things that this institution said that it believed at its core, that did more harm than anything else in terms of causing that damage. The question then is, well, why does that happen? And what might we do about it? Well, the explanation is not, I think, that people like prelates and prime ministers wake up in the morning and say, "Look, you know, how will I spend my day today? Let's see how much hypocrisy I can engage in by lunchtime. I'd love to go to bed with lots of cynicism, you know, generated as a product of my daily activities." There's an altogether more significant but mundane cause, which I think is worth bearing in mind, because it does have some implications for every member of the professions in this country. I learnt the sort of story, or the lesson of it, in an experience in a taxi cab here in Sydney, heading towards the airport one year. There was a royal commission being undertaken. You know how we have fairly regular royal commissions in New South Wales looking into one form of corruption or another? Well, on this occasion, there was a royal commission into the building industry. I'd been reading these fairly lurid stories in the newspapers about what had been allegedly occurring. I was in this cab, and the cab driver was telling me his life story, as they sometimes do. And he just said to me, look, you know, before I drove cabs, I used to drive a concrete truck. I thought, oh, that's pretty interesting. I mean, here's a person who's worked in the building industry. I can ask him whether there's any truth to some of these stories. So I asked him about what I'd been reading in the paper, and he goes, oh, mate. No, mate, you're building a hospital for the nuns out west at St. Mary's, and, one of the bosses, one of his mates, wants to have an extension to his house or a swimming pool put in, so the word comes down the line, and before you know it, we direct our truckloads away from the job in the hospital, and after a while, there's an extension, there's a swimming pool. I said, well, what's that worth? That must be a lot of money. And he said, oh, mate, thousands, mate. Yeah. He said, no, mate, there was something worse than that though going on. That's why I had to get out of the industry. So I'm thinking to myself, what's worse than stealing from nuns? You know, that was whole buildings are being relocated in the dead of night. And I'm thinking, this must be pretty serious stuff. And he said, oh, no, mate, had to get out. He said, somebody stole $20 from the lockers in the workshop where I used to get changed. And I wasn't going to have a bar of that. So I'm thinking about his relative sense of value. But we go a bit further and he says, well, what do you do? And I said, I run an ethics centre. And he said, an ethics centre, mate? He says, well, what's that? And I began to explain to him. And as I did, his face got really excited. He's got one hand on the wheel and he's tapping on it like this. And he said, oh, mate, everybody. Mate, an ethics centre. That's what we need, mate, an ethics centre. And I could see him now imagining that because this ethics centre existed, no one was going to steal truckloads of concrete from nuns and money would be safe in lockers and workshop. And I thought, this is fantastic. Here I am doing ethics with a cab driver and he's really getting there. So I'm feeling very pleased with myself. When we arrive at the airport, I ask for a receipt for my taxi fare. And he says, yeah, mate, now how much do you want it for? So something's gone wrong here. He doesn't quite get it, you know. Talk for 10 minutes about ethics, and the last question is, how would you like to rip off an ethics centre? But anyway, I thought that from his point of view that this was a kind of a reward from him to me for being a good passenger, an interesting conversation. Of course, if I had taken advantage of the offer, the money was not coming out of his pocket. It would have been from the petty cash tin at work. And so I asked him. I said, look, don't you think it's a bit odd that that you should, you know, make that offer after everything that's been said? And his face changed. He didn't get angry. He just looked a bit puzzled. But he said, mate, everybody does it. Mate, that's just the way we do things around here. And I'd love a dollar for every time I've been told that. You go in, I travel all over the world and I work in the public sector, the private sector. I work in civilian world and in the military world. And you go into organisations and you ask people, why do you do this? And the most common response is, everybody does it like that. Oh, that's just the way we do things around here. And that is the greatest enemy of ethics. It's not greed or dishonesty, as some people think. It's unthinking custom and practice. And that's what's happened to major institutions that we're going to have to address in the future. We're going to have to ask ourselves again, what are the purposes for which our institutions exist? And by institutions, I'm not just talking about things like banks, universities, parliaments, churches, but also the purpose of professions and devices that we've created, things like limited liability, the joint stock company. What are their purposes? Do we actually understand them? Do we know what they exist to do? And do we sufficiently understand them so that we do not inadvertently betray those purposes because we are simply doing things, because that's just the way we do things around here? So the next issue that I think we're going to have to embrace is the challenge of leadership. It was mentioned by one of the people who was commenting on the interviews prior to this session commencing about the importance of leadership. We do not do leadership very well in this country. We have programs which put leadership in the name, but they're actually management programs. They make people better equipped to deal with existing systems and structures, to work within the existing framework, to actually develop leadership, moral courage, strategic vision, the capacity to engage in constructive subversion, which is the hallmark of true leaders. Leaders subvert unthinking custom and practice. They are never content simply to do things because everybody does it. They always subvert that sentiment by trying to tie things back to an explicit framework of values and principles. And yet it's not a destructive process, and it's not about imposing some idiosyncratic view of the world. Great leaders, particularly great leaders in organisational or social contexts, seek to make the organisation or the society more like the thing it says it wants to be. And yet we do almost nothing in this country about investing in leadership. And it's a challenge we're going to have to face if we're going to address some of the challenges that we face. Part of that role of leaders will be to tackle what has been a precipitous decline in the confidence we have in the language of ethics. I'll ask you to think about these three examples and what we've done, our strategies for dealing with them. Firstly, an example taken from a number of years ago in Central Australia, where the scourge of petrol sniffing was decimating the young people around Mutijula in Central Australia. Everybody knew that there was a way to solve this problem. It was to bring into the centre Opal fuel, which had been developed by BP. It doesn't have the same volatile structure that is intoxicant and destroys the brain and the nervous system. And yet, the only basis on which that matter could finally be resolved was when a number of companies commissioned Access Economics to do a report to show that it would cost too much not to introduce it, that the more economically responsible option was simply to bring in the fuel. And so people said, oh, well, Access Economics says, you know, in the long run it costs too much not to do it. It's okay. We can bring in the fuel. Then look at the environmental movement in the debate about, you know, global warming and what role human beings and how these effects should be changed. They argued for a period of time that perhaps there were duties to future generations, which you would all be interested in, I imagine. Or perhaps there was a kind of a stewardship owed to the rest of the planet. Or maybe that there were certain kind of values that ought to be ascribed to nature and to species, creatures other than ourselves. Didn't get anywhere. Sir and now Lord Nicholas Stern produces a report that says, well, look, you know, in the long run, if we don't deal with climate change, it will cost too much. People say, oh, okay, so it's okay now to deal with climate change because there's an economic argument. Well, at the end of 2008, two charities that had been established to combat child abuse thought it might be useful and perhaps even necessary to do the same thing. They commissioned a report from Access Economics to show that child abuse costs too much. Now, I'd ask you sitting here today about what kind of society is it that thinks it necessary to seal the argument about child abuse with a report by Access Economics. Could we not just say child abuse is wrong? It should be stopped. Why do we think we need that further sanction? And this is not to say that we shouldn't undertake economic analysis. It's simply to ask what is happening in terms of our confidence in a language that might have said that something like child abuse was wrong, or any of the other examples that we ought to try and intervene. Why is it that we struggle with that? Well, there's a problem there, I think, in to do with what's often referred to as the moral muteness of management. It occurs in the business literature. It's where people do things for ethical reasons but then pretend they didn't, because they're embarrassed in some sense to invoke a set of values and principles, to have that kind of moral courage which is so distinctive of true leadership. So there's a trend there that we need to think about. How do we talk about institutions? How do we talk about issues? How do we evaluate the sort of course of action that we might take? I mean, ethics is ultimately a practical question, as you'd all know. The core question of ethics is, what ought one to do? So faced with choices, faced with decisions, how do we operate? A final thing that we need to think about, as I think is a general trend, is an emerging concern against that kind of background, and this is a countervailing factor, about preserving certain ways of life. You're beginning to hear now, and I don't know whether Bernard notices this as well, but in the debate, for example, about issues like water and water allocation, and all the floods in a sense have taken this, given us breathing space here, the effects of fire and flood and risk to various people, you're beginning to hear a voice emerging from some of those remnant communities in the red spots that Bernard was talking about, where the argument starting to be made has got nothing to do with what is economically or rationally defensible, but there are people beginning to say, we want to dig in preservation of our way of life. There's an eerie familiarity to some of the things you're starting to hear out of the bush. It sounds very much like the way Indigenous people speak, where they say, we're not going anywhere. Our family are buried in these plots. Three or four generations have worked in this land. And we think you people in the city ought to respect the fact that when you bring about the changes that you're proposing, it's not just an economic or other consideration. There's a way of life that is at stake here. And I think one of the things we're going to have to start to contend with in the future is what it means to address those kinds of questions. Well, there are some basic trends and observations. Let me try and suggest some implications for the profession that you belong to. The first thing is that there's going to be a requirement for, I think, I hope in a sense, a greater degree of literacy around the way in which we deal with issues in this area. Sometimes we think that it's enough to know just what the facts are so that people will decide these questions. But of course, the facts are never simply just what they seem to be. There are, for example, lots of facts about this room at the moment. If I was to ask somebody here how many light bulbs are illuminated at this moment, I sort of hope that no one could tell me, because it would indicate a rather bizarre kind of character that you'd counted them. But if I'd said to you beforehand, there's one of these new iPad version 2 available for the person who can accurately tell me this, then it's a fair chance somebody desiring one of these things would have done a quick count of the lights in the hope that they might be able to secure a new iPad, or if it had been a $10,000 check, you know. The things that we think are good, our values, shape the way that we notice things. And that needs to be part of the way we start to think about these issues. And similarly, and this perhaps cuts slightly more close to the particular role that the actuary plays, we need to understand that when it comes to the ethical domain, judging matters according to consequences isn't the only way in which the community thinks about these things. There are many things which people would not do irrespective of the consequences. You can think, as I do, sometimes in philosophical terms at rather extreme and bizarre cases, but I don't need to do that. I'm sure that you would all think now that there would be certain things that you simply would not do just because somebody was trying to tell you that it would have good consequences. There would be barriers to what you do there. And we as a society need to start to engage with our professions and say it's time for our professions to develop a much greater literacy around the way in which people make decisions, the relationship between facts, values and principles, the kind of options we have. But there's also a core issue that each of the professions have to deal with. Let me just speak specifically here in general terms firstly about this, and then a bit more specifically about actuaries. As you would all know, we live in a society which is largely defined by the ideology of the marketplace. That ideology has been brilliantly successful. At its core is the notion that each person legitimately pursues their self-interest, and due to the magic of the invisible hand, however you conceive of that, this net effect will be an increase in the stock of common good. The idea of the market, since it goes back to Adam Smith, sees no intrinsic value in markets. They're not good in themselves. They are good simply as tools to make us all better off. But they do have at their core that idea that self-interest will be pursued. And yet every single one of you in this room, to the extent that you self-consciously identify with being a member of a profession, have decided to step outside of that world. You said we are not part of that market world, because what defines a profession is a willingness to act in a spirit of public service, in which you subordinate self-interest to the interests of others, typically to society and then to clients. There's a hierarchy of interests, and every profession puts the individual interest of that practitioner at the very bottom of the list. So I don't know how often you think about this, that when you consider the sorts of issues which we've been talking about, Bernard and I, this morning, from a professional perspective, if you are serious about being a profession, and society itself values this, it tries to accord certain privileges to professions as part of its social compact, then you choose not to be living within that pure, unadulterated world of the market. A consequence of that is that you distinguish between interests and wants. A corner store might sell somebody a block of Dairy Milk chocolate without a single question. If they say, "I want a block of chocolate," and they can pay for it, there it is. But if the doctor that treats that person for diabetes is approached, the doctor will say without any hesitation, "I know what you want, but it's not my job to provide you with what you want. It's to discern your interests and to act accordingly." And so there's a primary role for the professions to say, well, how do we distinguish between wants and interests? And how do we do this when we operate within a commercial context? There's a notion about the defining good that each profession has. I'm trying to work out. I mean, some of them are just one words. They're simple. You can imagine lawyers having a concern about a defining good of justice. You can imagine accountants being concerned about truth. Notionally, journalists should do. What about actuaries? Well, insight regarding the probable as a service to allow us, the rest of us, to make more informed decisions. That gives rise to a certain set of core values. I would want you to be prudent. I'd want you to be diligent. I'd want you to be careful. Are these things part of the conversation that actuaries bring as they address some of these fundamental issues that we face? Do you reaffirm for each other a notion of interpersonal accountability, where you're not accountable so much to somebody out there but to each other? Does this institute stand behind you as an actuary? Can you rely upon the body of actuarial expertise within this country? And perhaps further afield, if you exercise the moral courage as a profession to stand up in the service of the community that you ultimately must align to, in the pursuit of interests, when it would be unpopular or difficult to do so, when you might be in a commercial setting where that's the last thing they want, but where their interests would be best served by you precisely doing that. Well, these are some of the issues. Why does it matter? It matters because of that point we are at in time at the moment, where we need people, particularly people within the professions, to use the language of values and principles, to talk about the ethical foundations for what they do, so that, the language to deal with things, whether it be child abuse or petrol sniffing, is not simply consigned to a point of irrelevance in favour of just a single narrative, which is around economics. We need you to do this so that we've got some people who are going to help society once again think about the integrity of institutions and the foundations that are there. We need you to do so that when you contribute your own voices in a literate manner to the discussion of the options that we have, you're well informed not just by a narrow understanding of your own particular discipline, but by a wider discourse. And we need you to do so, I think, because of the leadership opportunity that this represents for this profession in a time when leadership never mattered more. Thanks.
Thank you, Simon. Very provocative, especially the latter part, challenging us in our role in profession.